From KLW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents, context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Fairfax, California.
Glen Park.
Fillmore.
I'm from San Jose.
I'm from the Intermission.
UCCC World.
West Oakland.
East Oakland.
Coming up, healthcare goes out looking for patients.
All right, health fans here.
Okay.
Usual spot.
Only catch, no grown-ups allowed.
If kids start taking responsibility for their health, that it actually spills over into other areas of their life.
We'll also hear a commentary on the fertility industry and an investigative report into human trafficking.
Nobody knew really what human trafficking was in America until this case.
That was in the year 2000. Stay tuned for Cross Currents. Of all the opinions on the state of the American healthcare system, there's one group that often goes unheard: uninsured, homeless, and low-income youth. Kids are left without care for a variety of reasons: immigration status, homelessness, or gaps in public coverage. And when people don't get regular preventive care, an emergency room trip can end up costing the public 10 times as much. At least that's how much the Bay Area's teen health van saves for every dollar it spends. KLW's Jordan Katz climbed aboard the mobile clinic to find out how it helps local youth. And a note to our listeners, some of the names in this story have been changed to protect patient privacy.
The order's finished. You know who's won.
What's the quickest way to a child's heart? How about Harry Potter?
We need to get into Hogwarts tonight.
The staff at the Bay Area's teen health van know that their patients are no exception.
Nice job.
The movie drowns out any sounds coming from nearby exam rooms, helping preserve patient privacy.
What makes you think you can trust him?
Patients range from ages 10 to 25. Half are homeless. Most lack health insurance.
So the kids that we see typically have not had regular health care.
Dr. Seth Ammerman is a practicing pediatrician and medical director of the teen health van. Regarding regular physicals,
often it's sporadic or they haven't had any in years even. So that what we do is provide comprehensive medical care.
With funding from the Lucile Packard Children's Hospital, Ammerman and his team launched the program in 1987. It's a one-stop mobile shop that travels to every nook and cranny of the Bay Area's underserved neighborhoods.
Any pain today, hon?
No.
Today, it's parked outside the Indo-Chinese housing development in San Francisco's Tenderloin. Melissa Nguyen, 21, is up next for her monthly checkup.
There are days I don't feel good, having headaches and sleepless night.
Nguyen has no health insurance. She wandered into the van 3 years ago, complaining of a headache, and she kept coming back. Now, she says, she's a happier person overall.
Before, I kept to myself, and like when I don't feel good, I just still be like in my box, no one's entering it. And after I came onto this van, it's more like I felt much better.
She says the van's counselor has made a huge difference.
They actually made me feel like they've been there and they actually understand us and they're willing to help us one by one, one step at a time.
Patricia Soto Minder, the van's social worker, says she's on the lookout for certain psychosocial problems.
First of all, I do a psychosocial assessment to find out if the patient, I cover everything, you know, to find out if the patient is homeless, if the patient has any type of mental health issue.
Soto Minder says a lot of teens who come in feel isolated. Many have bounced between various foster homes and housing developments. Her role is to bridge the gap between patients and those around them who can help.
When we meet them, we're able to assess them and provide those resources that they're not in place. And if you mobilize those resources, that individual doesn't feel alone. And in that way, you can normalize their behavior, or you can move those resources that at that point the client needs.
The van has a comprehensive team that can provide virtually any kind of care. There's a doctor, a nurse practitioner, a social worker, and a physician's assistant. There's even a resident dietitian and fitness instructor. And what they don't have, says Dr. Ammerman, they team up with neighborhood organizations to provide.
So here's a Boys and Girls Club.
Hello.
Hey, how you doing?
All right. Health fans here.
Okay.
Usual spot.
The Boys and Girls Club offers after-school arts and crafts. Down the street, the Tenderloin Children's Playground hosts a kitchen for cooking classes, a gym, and a veggie garden. All are part of a wellness program designed to keep kids coming back.
It's very important that we meet the adolescents' agenda or priorities, as well as ours. And, you know, we try to address them all. One thing that I found is that if kids start taking responsibility for their health, that it actually spills over into other areas of their life.
Sally Martinez's family has been coming to the health van for 8 years. She says her family is stuck in limbo between qualifying for federal aid and affording private health insurance.
We don't qualify for Medi-Cal, and it's just me and my husband working. It's like we make, according to them, too much, but we have 6 kids, you know, so it's hard.
And 3 of the 6 are in college. But the van has relieved some of the pressure and is now an important part of the Martinez's lives.
Mm-hmm. They know all the kids' names. They know me. Actually, I called him to make sure they were going to be here today. I have his cell phone number, so.
Sometimes people are shocked at that. Oh, you're giving teens your cell phone. But it's really interesting because it helps, I think, build trust with the kids and is a bonding thing with them. And it's extremely rare that they don't call me with an appropriate question.
Maybe it's the cell phone number. Maybe it's just that these underserved kids know that someone somewhere knows what they're going through. Whatever it is, the Teen Health Van and its staff have given them a place to come home to. In San Francisco, I'm Jordan Katz for Cross Currents.
Are you uninsured or underinsured? You can tell us your story by calling 415-264-7106. Just leave us a message at 415-264-7106. That's how our next story came to us. Healthcare is an issue that affects all of us, young, old, rich, poor, and it's changing, often for the better. Life expectancy in the U.S. is above 78 years on average for the first time ever. And childbirth has now become possible because of new reproductive technologies for people who were previously unable to have kids. We recently aired the story of Angela Rogers, a 27-year-old egg donor. She made thousands of dollars by helping people who couldn't otherwise have children become parents. These are some of the letters she received.
Dear Angela, I've been thinking of you often recently as we get closer to the egg retrieval and hoping you're getting through the final phase without too much discomfort.
Hi, Angela. We just want you to know that for us, family has and always will be everything that is important in the world.
Hello, Angela. I'm very glad to meet you and your genes. When I was your age, I never imagined I would have a child in this manner. But here we are, and thank you for being interested in helping me realize a lifelong dream.
There have been so many starts and stops, so many disappointments.
For some reason, I did not find a man to love, to share my dreams, and be the father of my children.
We cannot really thank you enough for what you're doing.
All the tests, the shots, bloating, etc.
You seem to be a kind, thoughtful, beautiful, smart, healthy woman.
I don't know if I would have been able to do what you're doing when I was your age.
I'm glad you decided to be an egg donor, and I look forward to seeing where this process takes us.
But after Angela Rogers' 6th egg donation, she had medical complications.
So I went to the ER. They didn't really know what to do with me. I told them that I had had that a couple of years ago and needed to be monitored to make sure that there wasn't any severe complications, like that my ovaries weren't twisting. Because ovarian torsion is like your ovary is a water balloon and it's being twisted. And, you know, if you twist the water balloon, it's going to pop.
Angela Rogers received treatment, but her story, produced by Teresa Chin, brought up some controversy. After the story aired, we got a call from Susan Ciutat. She's a registered nurse, an attorney, and executive director of the San Francisco Donor Network. She was concerned about our portrayal of the fertility industry and came in to share this commentary.
These comments are in response to a piece on egg donation that was aired a few weeks ago. That show portrayed a very false image of egg donation. Egg donation is a wonderful opportunity for young women to give a precious gift to others. I think that fundamentally most people want a chance in life to do something heroic, and this gives young women that opportunity. I've had the privilege of working with over 300 couples who used egg donors, thus enabling them to realize their dream of starting a family. Egg donation has been in use for over 25 years. It's a safe and routine procedure, and there's no evidence of any long-term adverse effects. The risks are minimal, and potential egg donors are fully informed about the process before they begin, and they are well compensated for their time. The piece that aired a few weeks ago portrayed egg donation as unsafe and egg donors as young, naive women who are being exploited. This has not been my experience at all. Having worked with egg donors for the past 8 years, I've found that they are generous, thoughtful, intelligent women. They're usually college-educated and understand fully what they are doing. A large majority of egg donors choose to donate multiple times as they find the procedure safe and easy and experience no side effects or complications. Numerous studies on the long-term effects of the medications used in egg donation have found that there's no correlation between those drugs and any type of cancer, uterine, ovarian, or breast. In the show, Ms. Chin stated that the takeaway from her research was that the fertility community is woefully unprepared when things go wrong. In my experience, nothing could be further from the truth. Donors are very closely monitored throughout the entire procedure. The potential complications are well understood, these days usually avoided, and well managed when they do occur, which is about 2% of the time. It's difficult to understand how Ms. Chin came to the conclusion, given that the example she cited was of a woman who experienced a complication and was completely taken care of. And that young woman stated that she was glad that she had been a donor multiple times and had found the experience highly rewarding. For me, that is the takeaway from a close examination of egg donation: the fact that it is a highly rewarding experience for young women and their recipients. These days, many women postpone having children until their 40s for a myriad of reasons, only to find that they are no longer able to conceive a child. Any woman who has struggled with the ache in her heart of wondering if she would ever be able to have a child of her own knows that there is nothing more joyful than that moment of holding her newborn baby in her arms for the first time. And for a young woman to know that she is the one who made that dream a reality, that is what egg donation is fundamentally about.
That's Susan Siutat, executive director of the San Francisco Donor Network. So what do you think about the fertility industry? Have you had personal experience as a donor or recipient? You can join our conversation by leaving a message at 415-264-7106. That number again is 415-264-7106, or you can connect with us on Facebook. We're KLW News. Did you know that there's much more from KALW News online? The new KALW.org is your source for regional, national, and international news from our partners at NPR and the BBC, as well as our own news team. Twice daily, we round up the most significant stories affecting the Bay Area in our Connecting the Dots column. It helps you stay informed about our community. We also have plenty of online exclusives, including articles from our criminal justice and transportation reporters, our audio archives, and information about everything else you hear on your local public radio station. Just click on KALW.org. That's also where you can subscribe to our podcast. You're listening to Cross Currents from KLW News. I'm Holly Kernan. We now turn to the topic of slavery. It doesn't often make the headlines, but the practice is alive and well in the 21st century. According to an investigation in the San Francisco Public Press, there are more people enslaved today than at any other time in history. The U.S. State Department estimates that those enslaved through human trafficking ranges from 4 million to 27 million people. Human trafficking is the fastest-growing criminal business in the world, according to the State Department. It ranks only second to drug trafficking in profitability, bringing in an estimated $32 billion annually. The majority of those trafficked are young adults between the ages of 18 and 24, but children also make up a large part of the slave trade. In a joint investigation between the public press, El Tecolote, and New America Media, reporters delved into the dark world of human trafficking.
Oh, it must be hell. It must be total hell. Because she probably also has glimpses of how other people are living. Unlike in the village, where surrounding Lucky Reddy's home, it is utter poverty. So she probably thinks that's how it is. But here she sees people driving in fancy cars, enjoying so much freedom, being allowed to, you know, dress the way they want. But they are forced to dress in a certain way. They're never given an opportunity to go to school or improve better their chances of a better life. So, and they're also limited in the communicating with their families back home. It must be, I think, nothing short of hell.
Viji Sundaram is a reporter with New America Media and part of the public press investigative team that shed light on modern-day slavery.
So I'm wondering if you could start by telling us about the Lacquaretti Bali Reddy case in 2000 and what happened.
Okay. Now, Lacquaretti Bali Reddy was one of the richest, if not the richest, landlord in Berkeley. He had about 1,000 apartments, rental apartments, as well as he had a restaurant, which is very, very popular, Indian restaurant called Pasant. And he, you know, he's been... It was not known at all in the community that he was bringing young women, young girls, into the country to make them work in his restaurants as well as maintenance on his building, and giving them very little money, and sometimes no money at all. From what one of the victims told me, he believed that the fact that he was letting them stay in one of those apartments and giving them food was pay enough. And nothing would have come to light but for the accident that happened in November of 1999, when a girl in one of his buildings, a 17-year-old girl, died of a gas leak, which happened in the apartment building. And Lacquaretti, the other girl in the apartment, there were three of them living there at that point, but two were in the building when the leak occurred. There were two sisters, one 17 and one 15. And the third woman who was living there, an 18-year-old woman, walked into the apartment and saw this girl lying sort of unconscious and the other girl semi-conscious. And she called Lacquaretti. And then they'd all been in this country for just about 3 or 4 months. They didn't know the language. They had no idea how the law works in this country. So she called Lacquaretti. He came with his men and carried the girl who was, I think she was dead already, but he took her out of the room. And the third girl, the victim, who was very conscious and aware of everything, was making a racket on the street. Some passers-by noticed her. And then the police came and the whole thing came to light, and they did a little investigation and found that this guy had been trafficking young girls into the country.
So who were these girls?
These were girls from a village from the same village he comes from in India. It's called Vel Vadam. It's in a state called Andhra Pradesh. And Lacquaretti was the king of that village, so to speak, because of his immense wealth. Not just what the wealth he had earned while in the US, but he comes from a wealthy family of landlords. And because of his wealth, he wielded a lot of power over these people. Plus, many of the girls he brought here and whom he had working in his home in India were from the so-called, you know, untouchable community. They were virtually voiceless even there.
Even back home.
Even
in
back home.
And he sort of promised their parents that he would be giving them a better life, right?
He did. He kept saying, you know, you could enjoy the kind of lifestyle I enjoy in America. All you need to do is, you know,
give me your daughter.
And many of the mothers themselves, because of their wretched poverty, you know, they didn't even question this guy. They just assumed that Or maybe, you know, someday some people say they were complicit in all this and that they were aware that this was going to happen to their daughters, that they were going to be used for sexual servitude. But it was desperate. And, you know, they have this horrible dowry system in India where when you marry your daughter, you have to give her a substantial amount of money, give the groom's people a substantial amount of money. So it was a combination of factors, casteism, feudalism, the cultural stuff going on in India. And so Lucky Reddy was like a godsend, virtually.
Okay, so this comes to light because of that gas leak and the two girls dying.
It was investigated initially as an accidental case. But as the Berkeley police began investigating this guy, they found this other thing going on, the sexual servitude and labor violations, immigration fraud violations, because he brought these girls here as the children of people who were working in his restaurant and other businesses, you know. Mm-hmm. They were masquerading as their parents, went there, brought these girls here.
And prosecutors say that, so this case ended up changing a lot of laws around human trafficking in the U.S., and I want to ask you about that. But when prosecutors tried to try this case, it was very difficult because there weren't laws about human trafficking, right?
Right.
So explain that.
Well, this happened, as I said, in late 1999.
And it was prosecuted in 2000, right?
Yeah. In 2000, he was charged with a whole bunch of things. Labor violations, immigration fraud, trafficking young girls. They call it transporting young girls for sexual servitude. At that point, there was no laws at all, not even federal laws. The federal law came into effect a little later in the year, back in 2000. And the state had no laws at all. And, you know, some women's rights activists say that nobody knew really what human trafficking was in America.
Until this case. And then there were some laws that were passed after this case as a result of it, like AB 22. What did that do?
Well, AB 22, Sally Lieber, former then Assemblywoman Sally Lieber, who sponsored the bill, acknowledged that the Lucky Reddy case was what influenced the AB 22 law. The law provided criminal prosecution for traffickers. If you trafficked an adult person, it was anywhere from 3, 4 to 5 years in prison. And if it was a minor, it was up to 8 years. So it could be 4, 6, or 8, depending on the seriousness of the crime. And it also had provides for some restitution. But, you know, it was really not much at all. And you know, Lucky Reddy and he was not the only one charged in this. There were several family members, but he got the largest
sentence. Which was what, 97 months?
He was supposed to. Well, initially the prosecutor said for the kind of crimes he had committed, he should get 38 years. And then a whole lot of plea bargaining went on behind the scenes. And finally, the prosecution convicted him two counts of sexual abuse, trafficking for sexual abuse, one count of filing a false statement on his immigration and labor violations.
Huh. And where is he now?
He's back in his country. He was
he's back in India.
Yeah, he's back in India. He got out in April 2008. He registered as a sex offender under Megan's Law. But he's back in India, and he's enjoying the same hero worshipping that went on before this happened, which seems to suggest that, you know, he's paid off everyone. Even the police, they're not doing anything to investigate this kind of thing, because it is a crime even in India, even though he tried to take the cultural defense and say, you know, sex with a minor is okay in India. That's not true. And especially outside of marriage, no.
And you went and visited his village, right?
I did.
What did you find when you went there?
Well, what I found was this kind of a mindset among the villagers that even though the papers had carried the story of what happened in Berkeley, the people there still thought he was he was faultless, and that was he shouldn't be blamed. Even the parents of the two girls, the one of whom died and the sister who survived, even they said, you know, when I asked the mother, don't you want to bring the sister back, the 15-year-old back, after all that's happened? She said, no, as long as she's happy there. But she was convinced that Lucky Reddy was going to provide, give them the happiness she couldn't.
You're listening to Cross Currents from KLW News. I'm Holly Kernan, and I'm speaking with reporter V.G. Sundaram about human trafficking. New America Media and the San Francisco Public Press recently published an investigative series about modern-day slavery. I asked V.G. what happened to the kidnapped girls.
Some of them are here. Some, as soon as the case, the whole thing broke, Lucky Reddy shipped them, some of them off to India very quickly. And some of them are here. They're given a new identity, and they've started life afresh. But there is a lot of trauma. They're still going through a lot of trauma.
And were you able to talk with some of them about?
Yeah, I did, but I wasn't. You know, on the condition that I wouldn't disclose where they were or their names. Yes, mm-hmm. I was, and it was very sad to listen to some of the things they said because. You know, one girl said she's not a girl anymore. She's a young woman. She said she wakes up at night and feels that Lucky Reddy is in her room. And then she has to turn on all the lights to make sure he's not there. And she needs sleeping pills to give her a good night's rest.
So New America Media, El Tecolote, and the public press, the San Francisco Public Press, took on this big investigation into mm-hmm. human trafficking mm-hmm. Because it's happening all around us, and yet we know so little about it.
Yeah, the thing was, when it was actually the San Francisco Public Press that came up with this idea of let's do a package and let's do it in collaboration with NAM and El Tecolote. And at that point, we sort of suspected that maybe AB-22 was influenced by the Lucky Reddy case. And then when I did that part of the story, yes, we found that when we spoke to Sally Lieber, she said, yes, it was very much a part, reason why we introduced AB-22. But we also, another reason was the CASE Act, which is a new act started by an organization called California Against Slavery. And they are trying to get this on the November ballot because they feel that it stands a better chance of it passing, of it happening, rather than going through the assembly, California lawmakers. Because the thing is, Nancy O'Malley of the Alameda County District Attorney said, you know, anytime there's a punishment clause in any law, it's likely not to get out of committee because people don't want to crowd up the already overcrowded prisons, and they thought that it stood a better chance of passing as an initiative, getting the people to say this is needed, because they feel that the California AB-22 is not strong enough. Now, the Initiative CASE Act, on the other hand, it offers a life sentence, and then there's also a fine of $1.5 million, which would be a deterrent for people who are thinking of trafficking in children. And also, you know, the police will be trained better to detect cases like what happened in Berkeley, because as the civil attorney who filed a civil lawsuit on class action lawsuit on behalf of many of these victims said, if the police had been better trained, they would have been able to detect this happening. Because these girls who used to be standing on scaffolding and painting buildings, 15-year-old girls, and instead of being in school, and they stood out because they were in traditional Indian garb. Hmm. And, you know, it was actually the Berkeley High students who spotted these girls in 1999 and wrote about it in the school paper. But even at that point, they didn't.
So this is all in plain sight.
Plain sight. Mm-hmm.
Well, now, let me ask you about that. So the U.S. State Department estimates that between 4 and 27 million people are enslaved through human trafficking. Now, that range seems
wide.
Very wide and mm-hmm. sort of absurd. So why are the numbers so unclear?
Because it's hard to find, it's hard to detect a human trafficked victim, to spot them. You know, if you see a girl walking the streets, turning tricks, how do you know whether she's a trafficked woman or is she just a prostitute? It's tough to detect it.
So how prevalent do you think this is? Like, where is it around us?
I think it's very, very prevalent. It's very prevalent. And even trafficking for labor reasons. Right now, California is trying to get the domestic workers Bill of Rights. Mm-hmm. How do you know when a person... You see, they come from a culture. I can only speak from this particular case because I've investigated it.
This is India.
India.
Yeah.
They come from a culture where... You know, things are accepted. For a child to work in a house, even though child labor is illegal
officially
in India,
illegal, yeah.
It's violated all the time. So when you come to this country and you're brought to this country and this practice continues, they don't know this is really wrong and that they have recourse. They can go to law officials and complain. Now, these girls... as I said, they had all these cultural things, you know, and they had language barriers. How do they know that this they could have gotten help through law officials? Because their concept of what law officials can help, how they can help, is very different from how it is here. So they kept quiet. And this happens even when people bring young girls to work as servants in their homes. In clear violation of all labor laws, they just grin and bear it. They feel, and their passports are impounded, like in this case, in the Berkeley landlord's case, he kept all the passports of all these little girls. So what recourse do they have?
So Viji, you know, you've done this big investigation into human trafficking. What would you like people who are listening to you right now to know, people like you and me?
Well, you know, as I was telling you earlier, sometimes this happens in plain sight. When my friends and I, when we went to this restaurant in Berkeley, some of us used to wonder, you know, we used to see these young girls.
You're referring to
Lucky Reddy's Passan restaurant in Berkeley. We used to see these little young women, young girls, cleaning tables. And in fact, one of my friends made an attempt once to talk to some of these girls to find out, why are they doing this part-time? Do they go to school? And when she tried to motion them to come over, Lucky Reddy's, the men in the restaurant, the male staff, shooed them away, you know, didn't want the girls to come and talk to us.
Hmm. That so should if have you raised see a signs red like flag. That, yeah.
You know, and we never even suspected that this could be happening under our nose. And, you know, so it's always good for people to look out when they see a woman, a young woman walking on the street, not to assume she's a prostitute, but could she be a trafficked woman? And I would really like the CASE Act to pass because it offers training to police people to make them more sensitive to these things, to be able to detect human trafficking victims. And there's also the CASE Act also provides for social and legal services for these women. So I would really hope that the Act passes.
That's Viji Sundaram. She's a reporter with New America Media and part of the investigative team reporting on modern-day slavery, spearheaded by the San Francisco Public Press. We'll put a link to those stories at klw.org. And last night, the CASE Act campaign, that's Californians Against Sexual Exploitation, announced that they've collected 873,000 signatures to submit in order to get the initiative on the California ballot in November. That's it for today's Cross Currents from KLW News. The team includes Hannah Baba, Wendy Baker, Julie Kane, Martina Castro, Audrey Dilling, Chris Hoff, Nathaniel Johnson, Jordan Katz, Artem Skonochovs, Casey Miner, Erica Mu, Joaquin Palomino, Rena Palta, Stephen Short, and Katie Steyer. Today's show was engineered by Seth Samuel. Ben Trefney is our executive editor. And thanks to City Car Share for providing an alternative transportation option for our reporters. You can find them online at citycarshare.org. Also, thank you. We are listener-supported radio. Tune into Cross Currents tomorrow at 5. We'll take a wild ride exploring the politics of high-speed rail.
So we're trying to see if we can get a little money from the state, a little money from the feds, and then a lot of local money, and go ahead and do a big Caltrain upgrade.
That's tomorrow at 5 on Cross Currents. The song you're hearing is by Evan Taylor of Oakland. She has an intimate concert scheduled for Friday at the Matching Half Cafe in San Francisco, starting at about 8 p.m. For Cross Currents, I'm Holly Kernan.
I got a honeycombed heart, crystallized and never turning bitter. And when the cells get full, it starts to hurt. Liquid light inside has to spill over, and it runs down the seams and all my pores, and it rushes through my veins oh so slow.